Look at this. If God would make a change and say to Bereshit, a permanent change, that would mean that the world is not constructed in the most beneficial manner. That's what it would show. Sure.
He's
correcting you now. See, that is impossible. That's what Shlomo Melech says. Kol ma she'osa ki kol she'yaseh olekim hu yiyeh le'olam. Why? Olavein lehoisif mimenu in the greya. Because it's created in the most perfect possible way to last forever. It's created in a way that it couldn't possibly be perfected on in any amount. You understand what I mean? So therefore it's impossible to say that God is going to suddenly come along and make changes. Make changes means it's imperfect. He has to perfect it. That's impossible. However, a temporary change is possible. Why is a temporary change possible? Because a temporary change only means that at this time God made Kriyas Yamsuf in order to save the Jews, because the whole world, the purpose of the whole world is Torah, and if the Jews don't get out of Egypt, so then there's no purpose for the world. So a temporary change in the law of nature. But not because the law of nature is defective.
It's become permanent.
No. Now, if the change is a permanent change, that means that it's not correct for water to run in a straight line. That's not the order of the world. It would be better if the water would do the wall, become a wall. You see? That's wrong. Because when God created the world, he created it with the most knowledge, and this is the best way for water to be good, for the water to go. You understand? However, at a certain time, at a specific time, it's possible for God to make a change. Why? Because then the change is not vis-a-vis nature. It's not because of the... It's only for a specific expediency. You understand what I mean? For instance, if you have to, if the whole purpose of the world is for Torah, and if the Jews don't receive the Torah, there's no other nation to receive the Torah. So Torah won't be given, so the whole world has no purpose. So therefore God will intervene at that moment. Why? Because the laws of nature are defective. Of course water shouldn't run that way. No, because of the specific purpose. You understand? So it's possible to have a temporary change. Permanent change is impossible. Because what does permanent change indicate? That there's a defect in the laws of nature. That's impossible. Same thing with a Navi also. A Navi can change the halachas temporarily, but never permanently. Why? Because the moment the Navi makes a permanent change, what does it show you? It shows you Mishpat HaTorah. Defective, they have to be changed. There's something wrong with Mishpat HaTorah. Tayag Mitzvahs isn't made for man. You understand? However, temporarily it's possible to have a temporary suspension, because at this time it just so happens that it's better to be over a Tefillin. You understand what I mean? It's better at this time. Generally not. Permanent means in a general way. That's what the Rambam says. The mistake of those people who believe that there will be a permanent change in Yemos HaMashiach, he says, they don't understand the difference between a temporary change and a permanent change. If you're going to say that the animal world is going to change, that means the way God created the animal world originally is not the correct way. And the balance of nature is it wasn't created with the greatest knowledge. That's absurdity. That's absurd, because it was created in the most perfect way. Kol HaShiyasa Lekim Hu Yelolam Olavim Lohisit Menuin Legraya. However, if it's a temporary change, like let's say on Harabaya certain animals lose their instincts, then that's for a specific purpose. That's possible. But to make a permanent change in the animal world, that means a change in the order of nature, that's impossible. Shesh Shemei Bereshit is the greatest chachma, and it has to always remain that way. That's what I mean.
The first point we started off with was that every person must have a philosophy. It's impossible for a person to live without a philosophy. Because whatever a person does, it has to register in his mind either as a good or as a bad. Or as neutral. But neutral is also a philosophy. See? Now, when a person does something, he must, if he gets up in the morning, so he's taking the effort to get up. That's the case, he must believe it's good. Why is it good? Well, he's going to earn some money. He's going to make a living. Well, is it good to make a living? Yes. He's going to have some type of philosophy. A person is a human being is caught. He must be a philosopher. There are only two types of human beings. There are good philosophers and there are bad ones. But there's no such thing as not being a philosopher. And that's why you see, people will always believe in some good, no matter what. And it's something which they really can't extricate themselves from. It's because of our nature that we're condemned to live that way. I say condemned because the Rambam traces back to the eating from the Eitz Hadas Tov V'Ra. He says it's a condemnation. Okay. Now, I mentioned that the philosophy of the masses, in order to have a philosophy that the masses will be attracted to, it has to be simple. That's one requirement, because the masses aren't too intelligent. So they're not really abstract thinkers. The average person is not an abstract thinker. I mean, great. So therefore, it has to be a simple idea, and it gives them a certain security if the idea is very simple, and also it has to be an idea which is in line with their emotions. Because most people simply work, their modus operandi is their emotions, and it has to cater to their emotions. So that'll be the philosophy of the masses. Okay. I was raised that why can't a philosophy be complex and yet be attractive to the masses?
Right.
Because once it's complex, it means it's abstract. Complex means it cannot be close to the emotions and be complex. Because once something is complex, you see, it doesn't partake of the emotions. As a matter of fact, the Torah will not work out emotionally. If a person, for instance, has certain feelings about certain halachos, and they investigate the halachos, they'll see it doesn't work out the way they think. People have ideas about muktzah, for instance. Like, I remember somebody one time said he was in somebody's house. He saw them take a telephone on Shabbos and put it on the floor. So he said, hey, what do you mean? How can you touch a telephone? Well, the halacha is that if it's a tzarach gufo makoma, you're allowed to move it. So this person said, Moshe wouldn't do a thing like that. It's ridiculous. The Gemara says you're allowed to do it. Tanoim Aram did it. The thing is that people have a certain emotional attitude towards these things, like muktzah. And if they gain knowledge, they'll find that it doesn't conform. Halacha doesn't conform to their emotions because it's complex, it's abstract. And anything that's complex and abstract cannot conform to the emotions. Are very simple. They attach themselves to certain situations, and that's the, you know, there's no complications involved. There's no qualifications. Once you have a halachic system, it cannot be attached to the emotions anymore. Okay. How would we define a philosophy, though? We must define what a philosophy is. A philosophy, really? How would you define a philosophy? What would the definition? Somebody asks you, what is the definition of a philosophy? Philosophy of life. And this is basically what the Kuzri is all about. Because the Kuzri was this king that wanted to know what is the true philosophy of life. And it seems he was pretty smart. He asked a few representatives to come and present their case to see what's the true philosophy. So how would you define a philosophy? The definition of philosophy as being a search for the truth or knowledge concerning the good. Because it has to do with man. You can't say just knowledge per se, because knowledge embraces many branches. But philosophy has to do with one area in specific. What the good is for man. What is the good? And like I said, everybody is concerned with the good, so there has to be, it seems to be an important area. Okay. Let me ask you a little further. When we say what is considered the truth, right? Now, the truth, when we speak of the truth, we really, as you mentioned before, I mean, we're concerned that we automatically associate a scientific method or some type of knowledgeable method, right, for arriving at conclusions.
Logical,
you might say. But you'll notice, if you're going to say that, then you're only going to have a very few philosophies. I mean, we said before that everybody really is a philosopher. Isn't that true? So we must really refine our definition insofar as what philosophy is. If we're going to, we have to be more precise about our definition. All right? The thing that we're asking now is as follows. Do we say if a person has a philosophy that's false, would you call it a philosophy, or would you say that since it's false, it is not a philosophy? What would you say about it? Established. At least one person here agrees that it has to be logical. So since we've established it must be a logical system, so let's say logically we show that a person, there are many philosophies, and to, let's say a simple example, we'll show from modern science that some of the philosophies, ancient philosophies, are false. And it's not that easy to do because the philosophy is not really in the area of science, but certain things we can show are false. So let us say you have such a situation. Would you say, or let's say a person has a philosophy, the person lives down the block has a philosophy, he worked it out logically, but we know it's false because he's missing a fact. Would you say that it's not a philosophy, or would you say it's a false philosophy? Which term would you use in such a situation? But we've agreed that there is such a thing as a false philosophy, right? Okay. Then the question is, if there is such a thing as a false philosophy, so it would seem that there are no standards for philosophy. Or would you say that there is still law standards for philosophy? other side of the argument is this: it would be difficult to say that any stupid thing would be considered a philosophy. That's a little hard to imagine also, right? Okay. Some kind of limitation. But yet, let me ask you another question. Would you say, we said before that philosophy concerns itself with what, really? With truth concerning the good, right? So, we shouldn't say truth.
We should say good. That people,
it concerns itself with an idea of the good.
The idea of the good.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this. Are the proofs in a philosophy the philosophy, or is the outcome the philosophy? It's the outcome, right? So, in other words, the outcome as to what the good is really the philosophy, not the proofs, right? If that is the case, if you're going to say that the outcome is really the philosophy, so it wouldn't matter if the proof is false, you see, it still would be considered a philosophy, as long as there's an outcome, right? But if that's, why is it called a false philosophy? You see, if you're going to say that the proof itself is the philosophy, then obviously you can't have a false philosophy. Like, you can't have a false proof in geometry. If it's false, it's not a proof, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Then in philosophy, the question we have to ask is, what is the philosophy? Is it the logical process, or is it the result of the logical process? Now, if you're going to say it's the logical process, then it can't be false. Because it's not logical, it's just not a logical process, right? But if you're going to say it's the result, the outcome of the logical process, then you can have a false philosophy. So if that's the case, when would a person be considered a philosopher? As long as he has an outcome concerning what? Concerning the good, right? An outcome concerning the good. Now what I'd like to know is, what do we mean precisely by an outcome? In other words, it's a frame of reference, so to speak, right? It's a certain, philosophy means that you have a general framework in which you operate concerning the good. In other words, if a person is diversified, he has no philosophy. If a person in one moment, he does this action, and you ask him, well, why do you do this action? I feel like doing this. And every time he does something, there's another reason, then you can't consider it a philosophy. So philosophy has to be a unified approach concerning the way a person relates to reality in his desire to attain the good. All right? So if that's the case, we will have, then what we said before is true, that everyone really would be considered a philosopher. Right? Now we would reserve the term, we would reserve the adjective good only for those whose philosophy is, it has a certain, meets certain standards. Meets certain standards. But everyone will have a philosopher. Yes. Could, however, argue differently. One could argue, really, that not everybody would qualify as a philosopher, because it really does seem difficult to maintain that everybody qualifies as a philosopher. What we usually refer to by the term philosopher, you say. Why would you say, how would you change the argument in order to say that everyone wouldn't qualify as a philosopher, really? Say they don't know the search for the truth, that we admit there's such things as a false philosophy, right? In other words, can you maintain there's such things as a false philosophy, and yet we would still say that the average person is not even on the level of a false philosophy, but simply is zero. A false philosophy would already have to meet certain standards.
Well,
is it possible to maintain it? Yeah, see, the thing is, it's not, there's two things in philosophy we say. It is a unified approach, a certain unified framework with which a person views reality. Now, if the framework itself is broken and doesn't really show unification, then you can't really say that that the person is a philosopher at all. There simply is no framework. Some people do things at different times by various emotions. See? And they really, you really cannot say that they have any philosophy. Because a philosophy has to be some idea, a unified concept concerning how you deal with reality. And what the good, some unified idea, some framework about the good. Now, some people have no framework. What do we mean they have no framework? They operate according to a certain framework, of course. The framework is going to be something. They'll follow their emotions, let's say. But they will not say, I simply follow my emotions. If you ask them, why do you do that? They'll say, well, this is the right thing to do now. And why do you do the other thing? Well, this is the right thing to do now. But they contradict. Well, I don't care if it contradicts. You see? So the point is, a person who doesn't present a unified framework, you couldn't even include him in the group of people who are known as philosophers. The only ones you can consider a philosopher is someone who has some framework. It might be wrong, you see, but if at least it's a unified framework, yeah, then you can consider him a philosopher. Okay? Things like this. It has to be consistent. It has to be consistent to be a philosopher. It could be consistently wrong. That's right. But nevertheless, it's a philosopher. Is what about the belief? Where's belief fall in? It would depend. If the person simply believes in various things at various times, then it's, you know, it's broken up. It's inconsistent. Then it wouldn't be a philosophy. But if a person has a philosophy concerning belief, and there are philosophies like that, like existentialism, is a philosophy concerning belief, which maintains that the way you feel about certain things, you're in tune with a certain reality. There's an inner self which is in tune with certain realities that exist. Then it would be a philosophy. That would be already considered a philosophy concerning belief. But that at least is, existentialism is an attempt to show a whole, what they call, I don't know if you're familiar with it, a Weltanschauung, you know, a frame of reference, a world frame of reference. So belief, it depends. It could be, if it's just haphazard belief in various things which aren't consistent, then of course it wouldn't be considered a philosophy. But if it's, it could be philosophy concerning belief. Okay. Said before that we're all philosophers. It's a good question. Lon asks, let's say, for instance, everybody just follows their emotions at different times, and the emotions are conflicting. One time you do this, and there really is no consistency. But you say, my philosophy is I follow my emotions. I would say like this, that if it is an explicit philosophy, then it will be considered a philosophy. But if it's just implicit, see, when we said before everybody's a philosopher, we don't really mean it in the true sense, everybody's a philosopher, meaning that they really have a can present a philosophy. See, most people will not say, I'm inconsistent, I agree with it, I'm inconsistent, but I don't care. If you say that, then that is a philosophy. That already is, that's a different step already. A person that says that is on a different level. He has already come to grips with the fact that he's inconsistent, and he's maintained that this is the way man is. Consistency is not a value. So then he has a certain philosophy. But the average person will not admit he's inconsistent. He simply never bothered to think into the fact that there are inconsistencies, or never even tried to justify the situation. So correct the situation. So that person would not be considered a philosopher. That's your average person really is not a philosopher. So when we say everybody's a philosopher, what we mean is not really overtly. In other words, not explicitly, but implicitly he is following some idea of the good. He has some idea of the good, whatever he does. So he's like a subconscious type of philosopher. Yeah. But that would not qualify under the term what we usually call a philosopher. All right? The philosopher, the view of the philosopher. The philosopher was the first person that presented himself to the king. And he told him, the king wanted to decide which philosophy is correct. He told him, he said, that God has no knowledge of particulars. So therefore, the king who was looking for a way of action, a way of life that in which he can incorporate certain deeds which would be considered good before the eyes of God, the philosopher told him, you're wasting your time. There is no such thing. Because first of all, God does not know particulars. Because in order for God to know particulars, it would mean that God changes. Because if God knows that you're doing something now, then he knows that you're doing something, then later when you're doing something else, his knowledge has changed. And therefore, the philosophers maintain that God does not have knowledge of the particulars. That was a famous argument of the philosophers. The Rambam answers this question in the Maharai, I told you, and the Rambam says that God does not have knowledge like we do. He doesn't look at us from the outside. If that was the case, it would be changing. Because if he looked at us from the outside, like with a giant telescope, so then that would mean that right now he sees us doing this, and later he sees us doing something else. That would be a change in knowledge. But God actually knows us from looking at himself, which means because he has knowledge of his own nature, which is the source of all creation, he knows exactly how everything in creation works, is working. See? It's a different way of, different concept altogether. And he is not subject to time or change, and there's no such thing actually as time and by God. Time is just an accident of this this existence. But anyway, that's the we mentioned there was somebody else that believed that. We mentioned it was, I believe, the philosophers. Who was it? Bilam of Russia. Bilam. Because Bilam said, When God came to Bilam and said, "Who are these people?" So Bilam said, "Well, you see, he doesn't know all the time. I'll wait till I catch him at a moment that he doesn't really have knowledge, and then I'll do what I want." So that was an ancient philosophy. Yeah. That's right. Doesn't change. God's knowledge doesn't change. God knows the particulars, but he's not involved in, he's not in time. There's no such thing as time in so far. Time is only a part of this physical world. I mean, that was recently, that's really the nucleus of Einstein's theory. Modern physics shows that's true. And time is not something that exists per se. It's only something which is a part of the physical, part of matter. Okay. So God is outside that realm, and God knows everything, every particular, because he knows, since he is the creator, he knows how it was put together, and it's like the clockmaker knows what time the clock says, because even though he doesn't see it, but he knows it's ticking somewhere else. He could figure out exactly what time it is, because he knows how the machinery works. You see? So that's a different type of knowledge. That's a different kind of knowledge. That's what Rambam explains. That God knows what's doing in the universe because he knows himself. And that's really, it answers this problem. But it's a deep problem. It's not a simple thing. I'm just mentioning what the Rambam says. Okay. The philosopher didn't want to take away knowledge from God. I want you to understand that. The philosopher maintained that particulars aren't important to God. His particulars are not worthy of God's concern. They're not abstract. God is only concerned with the main ideas of the universe. The concepts, the ideas that... God is not concerned with the little things. I mean, whether a person's drinking a cup of tea now or he's not. It seemed to the philosopher that this is too degrading for God to be concerned with, too demeaning. God is only concerned with universals. What? No, Afar Yaakov, Bilam said. Umisporas Rova Yisrael. You know what I mean? Umisporas Rova Yisrael? Rova Yisrael means, Chazal say, that the Rova means the Zera, the seed of the Jews. So Chazal say that that Bilam HaRasha saw that God knows, can see when the sperm connects with the egg, and he knows which one is going to be a tzaddik or not. In other words, he knows, he watches and he sees he knows which one's going to be a tzaddik. So Bilam HaRasha, yeah, what? So DNA, right? DNA molecules, right. So it says when Bilam said that, because the things that Bilam said, he didn't know what he was saying. When he said it, he understood it, but it wasn't something he perceived originally. So when Bilam said that, he thought it was so degrading for God to have knowledge of such a base thing. You see? Like any human intercourse. How could God be involved in knowing something that seems like base? That's similar to the philosophers, but a little more so. What is the answer? The answer is because he was tied totally to the emotional. He didn't, and his emotions, he projected a certain framework on the world. Really, the truth of the matter is that idea only exists to us because we have certain emotions. But there's the greatest chachma involved in every aspect of human life. In procreation, in every area, there's God's chachma abounds there just like it abounds in every other area. So for God, God is not involved in that emotion that he was involved in. But he projected his own emotion onto the situation, and that's why he said that. He said it's degrading. See? But God, to God, it's all knowledge. You see, it's us that have. It shows you his level, by the way. That's why Bilam was really considered a Rasha. He wasn't a real Navi, like I told you. He was not a Navi. And it was just accidental that he had Navu, because he wasn't really a true Chacham. And he had his own emotions, his own philosophy, and he projected this. Because of that, his limited idea projected onto God. That's what Chazal. It's interesting, very interesting Chazal. Bilam did not have Navu. Let me make that clear. What happened to Bilam was just like Lavan and Harami. Lavan also, God came to him and warned him, don't go near Yaakov. That wasn't Nevuah. That was God used him as an instrument. It's just like if God destroys a rock. Are you going to say that rock has a relationship with God? Yeah, in a way. It's an effect. But it's not a relationship because the rock is deserving of communicating with God. See, Bilam was not deserving of communicating with God. God used him as an instrument because of different reasons. Chazal mentioned different reasons why. But that's he was a Rasha, because you see they killed him when they finally got him, they killed him. Good point. That's a very good point. In other words, the thing you see, the philosophers maintain that the knowledge of particulars is demeaning. It's only demeaning if all you see is the particulars. But if the particulars are an expression of the perfection of the whole system of Chachma, then it's not really demeaning, on the contrary.
Does it say that it's demeaning?
The next point was something which to this day is a philosophical question. The question is the question of creation. And again, the philosophers came to their conclusion because they found one difficulty. The difficulty they found was that if you say that there is a point of creation, it would mean that at a certain point God did a certain action. Right? Which means that he changed. All of a sudden he got up one morning and decided he's going to create the universe. Doesn't make any sense. Because God can't change. God is not like a person. Suddenly he had a whim that he's going to create the universe. First of all, he has no needs or desires that he should want to do something like that. You see? So therefore it becomes very difficult to maintain that. So what the philosophers maintained was that the universe was not created by God. But they believe that there is, that God exists, because they see the tremendous chachma that abounds in the universe and that's behind everything that we see. So they maintain that the universe exists like the mashal the Rambam gives, like a shadow of a wall. Just like a wall casts a shadow, so too God, so to speak, his shadow is the universe. It's not that he created the universe through an action, it's just the natural result of him. And the universe and him exist eternally. That's the conclusion the philosophers came to. See? Today, science is still involved in that question, as I mentioned, because they have discovered that there was a creation at this point. We know there was a creation, the Big Bang, right? But those who want to maintain that there is a constant state universe. So what they say is that it's going to pull back. Is right, the oscillating universe theory. So they maintain that what's going to happen is that it's going to contract and then it's going to explode again. See? Yadis maintains that that's not so. It's not a cycle. So far, as I mentioned last time, so far there is no evidence that it will contract because there's not enough matter to cause it to come back together again.
That we know of,
right. Okay. If you say that God changes, what it means is something else is going to affect him. Something extraneous affects him. Something can affect the change in him. Or else it means that he will change as a new need arises. Like a person will change. So a new need comes into existence, and then you're going to change. You get thirsty, so now you're going to move, and you're going to go get some water. In God, everyone agrees that in God such a thing is impossible. Because this would be a lack of perfection. We believe that way, the philosophers believe that way. There's no one that would say that God actually... Well, it's a pasuk. Ani Hashem lo shanisi. I, God, do not change. So when we say that a tefillah that Moshe Rabbeinu made caused, so to speak, God to do such and such, it doesn't mean that Moshe Rabbeinu affected a change in God. It means because of his tefillah, the situation was changed. And under that situation, this was what is supposed to happen. But the Torah depicts it in a simple way because people cannot understand. Most people can't understand philosophy, and the Torah is written on two levels. It's written for a plain person to be able to just have a basic idea there is a God, and for the tremendous chacham to be able to understand the intricacies. But that's why you have Torah Shebal Peh, you know, which fits into Torah Shebal Ksav. That's why it has to be that way. From way back, I mean, have always been upset by Torah Shebal Peh. Torah Shebal Ksav they weren't too upset about. But Torah Shebal Peh they're very upset about. Because it seems, they want to say, you're pushing things in there that aren't written in. You aren't written in the Torah. But I want you to understand something. What they fail to understand is that that's precisely the way it was written. See, it was written that way for a reason. It's not that, exactly, that for the real Chachamim to understand it, you see, there's a certain system, an intricate logical system which they must make recourse to in order to understand the in-depth ideas in the Torah. Yet, it's supposed to be understood by a regular person that can read the Torah and just have some basic ideas about the existence of God, because the Torah is not just for a few chachamim, but it's for everybody, for a whole klal. You cannot have chacham unless you have a whole system. So that's really the purpose. The Torah was written specifically in that way, that it should be on two different levels. You see? That's not a question of putting something in. That's a design. That was the way it was designed. Okay. Question is, how could there be a creation if God doesn't change? There's two things you have to understand about it. The first thing you have to understand is the time, point of time. You cannot say before creation and after creation insofar as God is concerned, because God is outside the realm of time. See? the fact that time is only something that exists in this physical universe. God is no such thing as time. Now, the thing is this. Insofar as creation is concerned, there is one answer. And it's the only answer. The answer is, yes. It means that it's his nature to create. The creation is a simply result of God's nature. That's it. It's not that it's a need. Not that it's a need that God needed to create. Creation results from him. That's part of his nature. It's a process of creation that emanates from his nature, not the universe itself. They maintain the universe like a shadow of God, and it's eternal. Whereas we say that it's a resultant of a process. That process is a part of God's nature. Is an expression of God's nature. You can't say part in relationship to God. Every word we use here is only metaphorical. Okay. All right. Into what the basic idea is concerning the what does the philosopher believe is the best way of life? And what was the answer? He had a very simple answer. There's only one way of life. That is the way of life in which you're totally involved in thought and knowledge, and you always think about God, it's chachma. That's your whole life. You don't care about anything else, and if you're in that state of mind, you will never have a problem, you'll never be envious of anybody, you'll never do anything bad, you'll be a perfect human being. All the virtues that the Torah speaks about will be yours, just very simply, because you're not involved in it, you're just involved in the chachma, and that's it. That's what that's the way of life for the philosopher. That's what he calls the active intellect, being involved in the active intellect. Okay? What the active intellect is a whole discussion of philosophy. Some wanted to say it was big machlekes with whether it's something extraneous. You see, something extraneous to God, or that really means the active intellect means God's ideas. But or was something created by God, a system of ideas that was created by God, set forth or stemming from God, you see, which governs the whole universe. But regardless, that was irrelevant as far as we're concerned. Okay. In conclusion, the philosopher maintains that there's no reason for a person to search for any type of religion, because religion means a certain type of performances which have a certain form. You have to have certain actions, certain activities. There's no need for that. Actually, instead of actions, you should have used really performances, maybe, or ceremonies, so to speak. So there's no such thing, because all God wants from you, so it's not that he wants anything from you, because the philosopher maintains, of course, God doesn't have any wants, and he doesn't really care about you in the sense that we feel caring about somebody. But in order for you to get close to God, the only thing you have to do is be involved in this active intellect. It means be involved in the life of thought. And then all perfection is yours. Okay? So therefore, there's no reason. Religion doesn't matter, really, what you do. All you have to do is be on that level. So you want to choose. If you want to choose religion for his country, you can choose anything you want. It doesn't matter. As long as it's something which is in conformity with perfection. Right? Okay. There's actually, we didn't mention this point. There's active intellect and there's passive intellect. Passive intellect means when the mind is young. So the mind is really... Passive intellect is where the intellect is really dominated by the emotions. That's passive. It's passive to the emotions. It's all its goals are. The intellect's being used by the emotions. And active intellect means where the intellect is being used for its own sake, for intellectual sake per se. That's the difference. Then the Kuzari's answer. Question is, how could he possibly answer him? So there is only one way. The answer is that the dream, the experience of the dream. Because he said he can't argue with a philosopher. The philosopher's argument is irrefutable. But he had a certain experience. And that experience was the dream in which God told him that his actions are no good, even though his intentions are good. Which means to say that there must be something more. There must be some type of activity which per se is pleasing before God. That's in line with God's will. And that's why he was searching for a religion. He mentions about the Christians and the Muslims, how they commit murders because they believe that this is a pious thing, because they believe that what he means to say is that they believe that if you could impose your religion or your way of action on others, this is something which is good, because God finds this type of action pleasing.
and that's why they attempt to subdue others in order to impose this true, what they consider to be true philosophy on the other person, so that God will find this activity pleasing. Okay, that's the and that's why they think they get a tremendous reward. Okay, and it's impossible they're both right, so therefore he has to know which one's right. And, okay, so the question is, if the philosopher's argument is irrefutable, so how do we know that? Why do we keep the Torah really? Because we do maintain that this is right. So the answer is, of course, the Kuzi we get to it later. But the answer is Maimon Har Sinai. Maimon Har Sinai is the evidence that we have that it's God's will that there should be a certain nation, or there should at least be a nation, which does certain performances which the Torah tells us that we should do. Okay? So that's really our what he uses, his experience is a dream, our experience is Torah Sinai. Okay. Now the last point is as follows. The last point that he says is that why does he mention in number three, the philosopher's reply, of course, is not, he can't reply to that. There's no reply to experience. Okay. Then four, the Kuzari comes back and he says that the philosopher, of course, he says the philosopher rejects the idea of creation, right? And then he says that but the gift of prophecy should be more common among philosophers. And he uses, yet we find that the true visions are granted to persons who do not devote themselves to the study or purification of their souls. So he uses what do we call it? What was the name? Right? He uses what he's saying in this chapter is this. He's trying to show. He's saying like this. The question is, it's true that the philosopher may be wrong, but why should he? What does he do with the philosopher's argument that God couldn't have created the world? So he answers it this way. He says, just like we see there are certain phenomena that the philosopher really doesn't understand, because, for instance, the phenomena of divining. How come some people could have these types of prophecies? So the philosopher has no answer to that. So he says, I must assume that there are certain things which he doesn't know. Then maybe he really doesn't know his metaphysics might be mistaken also. Maybe he doesn't have enough knowledge to know whether there could be a creation or not. Just like he doesn't have knowledge in other areas. And for this he shows that there are people that can predict the future and be correct even though they're not thinkers. You see, and the philosopher has no way of explaining this phenomenon. So maybe he doesn't have enough knowledge to really say, speak about creation. So therefore I must search a little further and I can't rely on the philosopher's metaphysic. That's the Kuzari's refutation. Of course, we say in the Torah, as I mentioned, that we don't follow such a thing of divining, because that's the whole thing of the false Navi.
Right.
We only follow evidence. But the Kuzari was right in doing it, because he didn't really say he's following that. He merely said that he's using that to show that there are phenomena that the philosopher doesn't understand, which is good. Therefore, he's going to search. He's going to continue to search. He will not allow the philosopher's argument to prevent him from searching among those who maintain that there was such a thing as creation. Over here, he says that as regards the Jews, I am satisfied that they are of low station, few in number, and generally despised. Now, why? What kind of a reason is that not to choose them? The answer is because he felt that those people who are doing what is pleasing in the eyes of God, it would seem logical that they should find God's favor. So therefore, if they're low of station, probably they're not doing the right thing. That was his base of his judgment. Jer 41. that was the scholastic reply. So we said that we mentioned that he quotes, he quotes from the scholastic the beliefs of Christianity, but then he says that he says here no logical conclusion. Right, and he says logic rejects that which you say. So the points that briefly he brings what he mentions has the difficulties. The way he mentions the points he mentions, the difficulties are obvious. In other words, the question of how it's possible that God should be physical. Because and then they say then the Trinity, the idea that he's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Okay, and we mentioned the Ramban's question. Because Ramban says that when they asked him, they said, do you believe in the Trinity? So he says, what do you mean by Trinity? If you mean three separate things, so then it can't be, you can't say God is one if they're three separate things. So you must mean like there's three characteristics in this one thing, right, which is God. So if that's the case, so then you can't speak of three, you have to speak of four, at least. Because the one thing which has all these three has to, you have to mention that. That's the main thing, right? So therefore, Nachmanides says, so that's impossible. So they said, they answered, they said, that's true. It's not something that's logical, but it's something that we believe in. So the Ramban asked, he said, how could you attach belief to an idea that doesn't register in the human mind? You can only believe something that registers. If it registers, then you can attach belief to it. But if the concept cannot register in the human brain, then how could you attach belief? Belief to what? You see? The idea can't register. Like a person will say, I believe in a square circle. Now, a square circle is something that you cannot envision. You could say the words, but it has no it has no meaning in the mind. So it's something which is completely impossible. So you can't attach belief is something that you can attach to an idea that registers on the brain. But if it doesn't register, you can't attach belief to it. That was a question that that's the way the Ramban formulated his question. Okay. Like a person would say, I believe that something is finite and infinite at the same time. So you could say the words, but it doesn't have any mental corresponding idea. So you could say, I believe that something that this thing is finite and infinite. It has no meaning. You see. So, okay. Now, that was one thing. Now, the next point we mentioned was that God changed the children of Israel. In other words, a Christian view was that they were the new children of Israel, right? So we mentioned this goes against all the prophets. So all the Nevi'im always say that Ani Hashem lo shanisi, I don't change, and Atem b'nei Yisrael lo chalisim, and you will never be destroyed. All, I mean, mentioned in many, many places in the Nevi'im that there won't be any change with regard to that. Moreover, in the Torah, it mentions, the Rambam says, and you know, the Rambam mentions openly that the mitzvahs are chukas olam l'dor ha'sechem, that an everlasting law for your generations, and all the mitzvahs in the Torah were given forever. There's no ways, there's no mitzvah in the Torah which is mentioned, is only given for a period. On the contrary, it's always mentioned as an everlasting law, you should always keep these laws. So to say that God suddenly changed would be an absurdity. Okay. Moreover, rationally, it wouldn't make any sense that God should change his mind from what he gave. If he gave a perfect system for man, so then there's no reason to change. And if there was a more perfect system, he should have given the more perfect system. You follow what I mean? Okay. Laws that only apply in certain conditions. Like, for instance, there's no sacrifice anymore because you have to have the Beis HaMikdash. Just like the law of mezuzah wouldn't apply if you didn't live in a house. At certain conditions. But the law itself can never be abrogated. Okay? Like tzitzis and tefillin, anything which the conditions, which you, any mitzvah which you have the conditions, that can never be changed. They maintain that they keep the laws of idolatry, yet if they maintain that Jesus is God, so it says, you know, let's have an image a graven image. You should make any graven image of God. But at any rate, but the point is that the contradictions are many. Okay. He doesn't really go into the contradictions. Then next he has the Islamic system. Right? Islamic religion maintains that that you could tell from reading the book, the Quran, that it is inherently a miracle. This book is a miracle. So somehow or other, when you read that book, you're supposed to be inspired or come to the conclusion that no man could have written this book. So he said, because of this beautiful verse. So the Khuzri said, well, I can't possibly entertain such a proof because I can't read the Arabic. You see. So he said, so to me, and if you translate it, it would lose the whole miracle. So therefore, he says, I can't accept this. Also, he mentions that the Islam believes in a physical paradise. where the body exists in paradise and has actually that's in the Quran. In the Quran it mentions that the person that is just and good in this life will have women and good food and all the physical enjoyments.
Okay.
Precisely those things which he wasn't supposed to enjoy in this world, he will have in the next world for standing over here. Okay. Question on the Kuzari in this case is, question on the king is, that he says he doesn't know Arabic. Okay, so learn Arabic. If the if it's such a miraculous book that once anybody learns Arabic, they'll be able to see the miracle. So what kind of a an answer is that? That I don't know Arabic. Doesn't disprove Islam. Islam rejects embodiment is what prevents Islam from really being considered Avodah Zarah. Because they believe in one God. So that's why they're not considered idolatry. If you want to say it means that it shouldn't be limited, so they should have said that this is not the type of miracle that would suffice. In the beginning of 6, on page 43, he seems to be saying something like that. Like, if one is to believe, to be guided man is divine, because God speaks to man, so he must be convinced of it by means of generally known facts, which allow no refutation, and particularly imbue him with the belief that God has spoken to man. Then he says, but your book, I'm not an Arab, so therefore I can't read it. I mean, he should have said that you know, that's not the kind of miracle that would suffice. He means like this. See, the first part, he's saying that in order for a person to be convinced that God speaks to man, you have to have some type of rational demonstration. That's number one. But somebody could argue that there isn't any rational explanation, but there's an experiential proof. There's no rational proof, but there's an experiential proof. So in other words, there's two types of proofs that a person can have. Either a person can have a proof through through rational ideas, through concepts, like the Torah presents certain ideas, right? Or else a person can have can go through a certain experience. You can say, look, try this experience, you'll be convinced. So he says like this. He says, insofar as the rational proof, I don't see any rational proof here. You're not presenting any rational proof. But now you're telling me that there's an experiential proof. Well, I as a judge, I can't go and try everybody's claim for an experiential proof. Proof. I have to make a decision. It's not rational for a person who has to make a decision to go and follow everything that anybody says. A person says, well, try this, you'll see it's right. Try that. There's thousands of possibilities to try. No rational human being would ever do such a thing. And let's say he tries and it's not a person. He's going to spend 2 years of his life learning language just to try and see if this is miraculous. Let's say it concludes it's not miraculous. You know what I mean? So therefore he's saying it doesn't make any sense for me to pursue this type of a proof. If you want to present to me a system of ideas, then I would agree. But you have no system of ideas, no real conclusive proof, no factual proof, so to speak. So the only kind of proof you're presenting me with is a certain experiential proof, that if I read it, I'll be convinced that it's miraculous. He says, well, unfortunately, I can't read that. So it doesn't make sense for me to try to... try and experience just because somebody says that this experience is going to give me a proof. Like this. Then the Kuzri in 8 says, Al-Khazari, he says that because the doctor said that the miracles were performed by him, but they were not used as evidence. So he said that the human mind cannot believe that God has intercourse with man except by a miracle which changed the nature of things. He then recognized that to do so, he alone is capable of creating them from naught. It must also have taken place in the presence of great multitudes who saw it distinctly and did not learn it from reports and traditions. Even then, they must examine the matter carefully and repeatedly so that no suspicion of imagination or magic can enter into their minds. Then it is possible the mind may grasp this extraordinary matter, that the creator of this world and the next, of the heavens and lights, should hold intercourse with this contemptible piece of clay. I mean, man. Speak to him and fulfill his wishes and desires. Okay, this is an important paragraph, in 8. The important thing I want to emphasize here is the fact where he speaks about the idea that a person should come to the conclusion that God should have intercourse with this contemptible piece of clay, as he calls man. You see, like we mentioned last time, that most people feel, no, it's really appropriate that God should speak to man. Like, there's a natural feeling that people have that it makes a lot of sense that God should speak to man. So that idea is false. That's really a part of man's emotions, his own egocentricity and his own haughtiness, that he feels that God, it's right that God should speak to man. But see, David HaMelech says also, he says, Mo'anash Kisus Kareta, who is man that you should consider him? And David HaMelech says, V'anochi Talas V'lo Ish. You know, all the great men, there's one thing you see from the Kuzari, that this king, it shows two things. It shows the Kuzari himself, and it shows about the king, if the report from the king is accurate, that this king was certainly on a high level. You see, it's an interesting thing, but I one time asked a question. I said, why is it the Torah says that the biggest mitzvah, the most creature and very small, and through recognition of God, he realized that he's, recognition of Chachma, he realized that he is nothing. Now, I've often asked the question, why is it that practically you don't see that to be the case? In other words, you see people who are religious, and they say Shema twice a day, they claim to love God, and yet you find that they're just as haughty, if not even haughtier, than other people. You see? Because on the contrary, they feel, look, God is concerned about me, and they have this feeling that God loves them very much and watches over them constantly, so they feel I must be pretty important. So they come to the opposite conclusion, that really leads them to haughtiness. So why is it that this mitzvah, which is supposed to make a person very humble, oftentimes results in a person, on the contrary, you see, offhand, I mean, religious people, many religious people you can think of, I mean, aren't really more humble than people who aren't religious. Sometimes they're even more haughty. So why is that so?
Each individual?
Yeah. Okay. So Chav is asking questions. She definitely says, why is it that God doesn't really talk to man more frequently, at least once in a generation, right?
Right.
So that people would know there's a God, and then they would believe in him, right? That's a good question. Why is it that you see that the Jews, even though they heard the kolos and they saw the miracles, and yet you see that it wasn't too long, they were denying what they received. But the truth of the matter is that they really, if you look at most of the complaints in the Torah, it wasn't against God. It was against Moshe and Aaron. But no, they don't really, you see, Moshe and Aaron said to them that you're really complaining against God. That's what they told them. They said, you're really, it's actually, but you're displacing it onto us. That's what they said. You're displacing it onto us. You really have complaints against God, and you're blaming us for it. But they openly would never go against God. Even the golden calf, you see, explains later, was not really against God. But it's an interesting point, though. The answer, I think, is what exactly do you mean by love of God? See, now love has two forms. You could love an object, which is something that it's external to you, but you love it because you admire it. You have an admiration for it. But the object is not a part of you. There's another kind of love, however. It's a love via identification, where you identify with that object, and the reason why you love it is because that object is part of you. You see? It's an extension of yourself. Now, the thing is as follows, that most people's love of God is really not the true love of God. They don't perceive God as in something external to themselves, but they identify with God. It's an identification with God. And the reason why they identify with God is simply because of their own emotional egocentricity, like I mentioned before. That's the mechanism. See, even Rishei Olam, even the worst, most wicked people, identify with God. Hitler, Yimach Shemo, identify with God. I said, God chose me, divine providence, especially when the bomb exploded and didn't get killed. I said, you see that? Divine providence, I'm supposed to be the leader of the German people. And if you look throughout history, the greatest despots always believed in God, or in a force which would be analogous to God, a supreme force, which is guiding their lives. Now, why do they believe in that? Because this belief is not a belief of God. This is simply identification. It's an extension of their own egocentricity onto... They don't want to believe. See, they have tremendous egocentricity, and they can't simply believe that they're, you know, mortal man. I'm a mortal man. How egocentric can you be? You're only a few years, and then you die, and it's all over. So in order to raise themselves to a higher level, to really be considered immortal, they have to tie in with some type of divine existence, like God. So that's why they're very happy to believe that the supreme being... is relating to them, and they're a part, they're associated and identified. This raises them, removes them from the status of mortal man. This is nothing more than an expression of their own egocentricity. Now, this emotion, which you find in despots, and you find in the worst, most wicked people, unfortunately, that emotion is found to a smaller degree among regular people also. Same emotion, same exact emotion. You see, religious people as well. The emotion really, they start off with the premise that they are something special. That's the premise. And the way, and
right.
Well, yeah, that's true. So inclination is for a person to take it in that way, as being, as an extension of his own greatness. And that's why there is a tremendous desire for a person to associate with God and to identify with God and to love God. That love is not the mitzvah haftei sof shem lekecha. It has nothing whatsoever to do with it. That is a crazy emotion. Like I say, the worst rishonim have that same emotion.
So what's that?
There is another. The love of God of the Torah is a totally different thing. It's, first of all, the person has to recognize his own mortality. The person recognizes what he is as a creature. Just from what he sees rationally and logically, what he is. He's a creature. He's a species, just like any other species. True, he has certain capabilities, his intellect. But if a person would look at himself just with a clear mind, with knowledge, he would see right away that he is, just from what he sees, that he is a mortal being. And that is really the proper attitude that we should have towards ourselves. The first thing is the person has to have the realistic concept of what he is, what a human being is, you see. Then, when he looks around, he starts seeing that there's a tremendous world of knowledge surrounding him, like the Rambam describes. And he becomes aware of a source of this knowledge. Now, when he becomes aware of the source of knowledge, and he recognizes his own mortality, he doesn't identify with that source. There's no identification. There is just an awe and an admiration, so to speak, of the source of that creation. And in that situation, he finds himself feeling very small, even smaller than he did before when he only recognized his mortality. So the true Avas Hashem really is recognition of God as an external. If it comes from identification, then it's really an egocentricity. It's a total egocentricity. And that's the same desire that you find in primitive tribes and in all, basically, actually, it's the motivating force in religion in general, in religion in the world in general. See, really, what is the central theme of religion in general? It's salvation. Christianity especially, salvation, personal salvation. Now, personal salvation is because a person can't tolerate what he is. And that's why you have, the scientists are always lock horns with the religionists. Because the scientists say, this is crazy. I mean, you're positing something which is a total fantasy. Man is just a creature, he lives, he dies, you're trying to posit that he's something other than that. And you're trying to make yourself into something that you're not, and you're creating a whole fantasy about man. You should be more realistic about man. Actually, they are right in that respect. They are right. But they are wrong in denying that there is a creator. You see? In one sense, they're right, but in another sense, they're wrong. The religionists are really, basically, the religionists are involved in an extension of their own egos. That's most of the time. That's really what the religion caters to. And that's why people grab onto religion. Why don't they question when people see these programs where they project the idea that God will speak to you and this? Nobody questions and say, hey, that's absurd. I mean, how is it possible? The creator of the universe can speak to me? It doesn't make any sense. Nobody says it. On the contrary, they latch right onto it. They catch onto it. Why? Because it caters to the emotion, that desire to be part of something immortal. They want to be immortal. And this is an opportunity for them to be immortalized through religion, through an identification with God. So it's something which caters to them and which really attracts them. Now the Kuzari says, on the contrary, it's something which should appear as an absurdity. If you look at man rationally, it doesn't make any sense. That's why Einstein said there's a God, certainly there's a God, but he couldn't accept the idea of a personal God. It doesn't make any sense. The creator of the universe, what is a person? He lives a few years and he dies, and he created the whole universe with all the laws and the whole symmetry in the universe and the harmony and all this chachma, that the source of all this chachma is related to me. Doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't make any sense, you see, in truth, if a person looks at himself realistically. But a person who looks at himself in fantasy and it caters to the emotion that wants to identify with a supreme being because he wants to think he's something other than he is, see, naturally it's going to sound great to him. It'll sound very pleasurable to him. It's pleasurable and it's enjoyable. But if a person is a chacham, he sees that as false. And that's why the Kuzari says that, that's what he says over here. He says that it seems ridiculous. Unless you have a proof, I can't accept something like that because it doesn't make any sense. We say the same thing, but we say that there is a proof. So we say that that there is a proof that it is. It's a fact. It's a fact which is astonishing, something which boggles the mind, but we have no right to decide what God should do, whether he relates to man or not. If we see that he does, then we have to accept that. We can't decide what God should do. But it shouldn't be a comfortable feeling. If it's a comfortable feeling, it comes from egocentricity. And that's not Avas Hashem. It has nothing to do with Avas Hashem, nothing to do with the love of God at all. It reminds me, really, the pharaohs, like the way Chazal depict them. And historically, it's correct that the pharaoh was a god. He was considered a god. He was considered immortal. You see? Like he wouldn't, that's why it says that he went out, he went to the bathroom privately, no one should know. See? That was really it. The Chazal. So why? Because the pharaoh considered himself, that was part of the primitive mind of identification and rendering himself immortal. And when he died, so they put him in these big tombs which with his servants, and his, he's going on. He's not a mortal man. It was a denial of man's mortality. So that was the whole idea. That idea is just as prevalent today as it was in ancient Egypt. The only thing is that our rationality does not permit us to do it so openly. But the emotion is still there. And you see how powerful it is and how captivating it is. That's the attraction of religion. That's the religious attraction. But it's false. Yeah. The reason why, I mean, we can't say really the reason why God does or does not do things. But let me put it this way. Exactly. If God would produce a sound out of the skies that would people would hear, so naturally they would believe in God. But what kind of a belief would that produce? Would that promote? That's right. It would cater to that underlying emotion. It would be just like Avodah Zarah. So Yahdus is supposed to be a rational religion. It's supposed to reach God through knowledge and through contemplation and through thought, not through a mystical type of identification. If somebody would experience that, then immediately of course they'd believe. But what kind of a belief would it be? It would not be a rational belief. It would just be. It would convince them more than ever that these emotions of their immortality and their egocentricity are correct. Magic was done to promote and to produce, to instill this type of feeling in people. See, and that's why what you mentioned before was that how come the Jews. And my wife mentioned why the Jews kept on denying, or they really weren't, they didn't reach the level. The reason is because Maamar HaSinai was a fantastic thing. And it took preparation. Moshe Rabbeinu prepared the Jews for 49 days, and with everything that went into it, in order that it should be a rational experience. But nevertheless, it wasn't totally. See, it wasn't totally taken in the proper way. And that's why there was so much corruption in spite of those miracles. People say, hey, how is it possible? You saw all the miracles, you know? The answer is because all those things can cater to different parts of man's nature, which is not really the pure part of the soul. And it could be just as corrupt in spite of the miracles, you see. The only way, that's why the Gemara says that they went 3 days in the desert, and Moshe Rabbeinu said, they didn't find the water, and they started complaining. So Chazal tell us, the Gemara says that Moshe Rabbeinu was misaking that they should read the Torah 3 times a week, like we do. Why? He said, I see that they went 3 days without Torah, look what happened. So Rabbi Soloveitchik one time said, he says, see, all the miracles cannot do what the Torah could do. Yeah. 3 days, oh, they saw the miracles, 3 days later they're off the track already. But Torah is the only way that a person can really get himself back on the right track. And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu saw right away. He saw the problem. Because he knew that all these miracles can only cater to the part of man that's really corrupt. Just as much as they could be evidence for the true ideas, they could also cater to the bad part of man. And that's why all the miracles don't work. That's why the only way, the Torah maintains, there's only one way. And this is the whole essence of the Torah. There's only one way that a person can reach God, through knowledge. There's no other way. Miracles, nothing can do anything. Nothing can help them.
So what were they?
The only reason that Sinai had to occur was because without that, there would be no basis to... it would be absolutely no basis to start. Yeah, there wouldn't be any basis. There had to be a basis. So it had to occur. Right, there had to be a basis, in fact. Right.
What about Mitzrayim?
But for the succeeding generations, the basis remains a logical one. But it doesn't have the emotional factor of a Maamar HaSinai, which would really destroy a man's approach to God. Not just the recognition of God as being external, but of course, it is qualitatively different, absolutely. There's a being that's qualitatively different, absolutely. That's really part of the recognition. But there can't be any... Yeah, but there can't be... It can't be... That's only possible, of course, if it's external. If it's internalized, so then it's not going to be something different. It's going to be an extension of yourself. Then your idea of God can't be something different. You see, that's why Christianity basically caters to that extension concept. Why? When they introduce a man-God. Because a man-God is something that a person can cater to a person's extension. Yeah, it's a human being, you know, you can identify with it. And he feels, you know, he can have all the feelings about himself, he can identify with it, you see. So that's why that's such a powerful attraction. In other words, if you start off with the right premise, if a person the way the Kaisers over here started off was the right approach. He had the right approach because his approach was to start from the rational, and that's really what the whole book is about. His approach was the right approach. Start from seeing what's rational. Rationally, let's take a look at what we are first of all. Rationally, let's see what we are. And all evidence indicates that we're mortal. We only live a certain amount of time. There's certainly nothing great about us. I mean, in comparison to the universe, which is eternal, I mean, in terms of wisdom and knowledge, and like he says, the entire universe, when you look at the chachma of the universe, you recognize that you're nothing. That's the way he started off. That was the right approach. If a person starts off with that premise, then he can get to the true Avos Hashem. But if he doesn't start off with that premise, if he starts off with the premise of egocentricity, then his whole idea of Avos Hashem is a warped idea. He never will reach that idea. However, if he starts off with the right premise, an accurate assessment of himself, and then he investigates, the more he investigates, the smaller he will become. Even smaller than when he first started. Rambam says that there is a direct ratio between a person's love of God and his knowledge. Direct ratio. He says it cannot exceed his knowledge. It's an interesting Rambam. He says it will not exceed, there's a direct ratio, his love of God cannot exceed his knowledge. What does he mean, it cannot exceed? A person can be emotionally imbued with the love of God. Yeah, but that emotion, you have to be careful. Because the emotion comes from the other part of man. It's the identification part that he thinks he has such a tremendous love of God. But if it's from the knowledge, then it has to be in direct ratio. And that's why it says right away, the next pasuk. These words should be on your heart. So Rashi says right away, what does that have to do with the previous pasuk? He says, because the only way that you can have love of God is through these words, through knowledge of Torah. If you don't have that knowledge, you're not going to have the love of God. See, that's really Yadis. That's where Yadis is totally differentiated from any other religion. That is the difference. A person who reaches the level of understanding God, even though he's not personal, even though he doesn't recognize personal God, is on a very high level. You see, on 218, he mentions... he says, the most sincere among them speak to the followers of a revealed religion in the words of Socrates. My friends, I will not contest your theology. I say, however, that I cannot grasp it. I only understand human wisdom. And he says, right before this, we cannot blame philosophers for missing the mark, since they only arrived at this knowledge by way of speculation, and the result could not have been different. See? See where he says that? He says, you cannot blame the philosophers, because that would be like a person like Einstein. who was on a very high level, but never, you can't blame the man for not reaching the conclusion, because he simply didn't have the evidence in front of him. Okay? So therefore he concluded there's a God, but not that he's a personal God.